everybody. Happy Friday. Welcome to the Game Life Podcast. It is Friday, October 31st. No, we don't have three theremins here in the room. That's just the cast of the Game Life Podcast. First of all, myself, Chris Kohler. Hello. Also with us here is
Peter Rubin, senior editor at Wired.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
And
Ian.
And Bo Moore, right, for people about games and stuff.
Bo Moore is back.
I am back. We haven't had the three of us in
Chris Baker to Nerd Stop
kind of a
and
while.
Traded him in for a younger, yep. newer nerd.
That's true.
Yeah.
But schooled in the ways of the elder.
So here we are talking about the video games again. Some news. I like to talk about Nintendo because Nintendo is always good about just releasing little bits of news that we can talk about. I think
they listen. I think they understand our metabolism.
Yes. So kind of a lot of little things that they announced. They had just announced their financials for the year. And actually, once we're recording this a little bit early, I think by the time you guys hear this on Friday, they will probably have had a press briefing or an investors briefing at which some news may have been announced. So we're kind of playing with fire here, like maybe they're going to announce something big. But so far, we can only really talk about what was reported in Nintendo's financial results. And this gives us a little bit of a window onto how Nintendo is doing. By some accounting methods, they are turning a profit. I'm not a financial guy, but even though they lost a lot less money on an operating income basis, but they actually made significantly more money on what's called ordinary income and net income than they had during the 6 months. So far we're halfway through Nintendo's fiscal year, which begins in April. Mm-hmm. So basically, we're 6 months in, and as compared to here's the interesting thing: Nintendo is selling less on a dollar or yen basis. They're taking in less money from sales of products or whatnot, but they are more profitable. So Nintendo is doing that thing that they kind of have to do, which is, if they're going to be selling less stuff, they have to figure out a way to be profitable while making less money, cost savings and things of that nature. So Nintendo is more profitable than it was, although, Michael Pachter commented on this and pretty much put it like, look, yeah, they're better than they were, but, one quarter is not a trend. Like, this is not, there's still the long-term outlook is still shaky. This should not be taken as evidence that this is where the tide begins to turn and it takes off. Good to see that Nintendo is following a more austere strategy and is reducing its costs, which ultimately is what it needs to do. If it's going to sell fewer products, it at least needs to be making money doing that, which it's what it did during most of the GameCube years. It wasn't selling a whole lot of GameCubes. It was its worst-selling home console ever, but they darn sure, they made money during most of those years. Now, the other interesting thing that does, I think, impact you and me is that they kind of released more recent, really up-to-date numbers about worldwide sales of their hardware and software. And this is... So we can absolutely see that Nintendo has had a much better 2014 than it had a 2013 with the Wii U, that its efforts to get the Wii U turnaround, largely have been Mario Kart based. Mm-hmm. We had the anecdotal evidence that Nintendo was selling more Wii U's thanks to Mario Kart. Now we really have numbers, and so just to, I don't want to bore you too much with numbers, but between April and September 2013, it had sold 230,000 Wii U's in America. April, September 2014, it has sold 630,000 Wii U's. Yeah, so that's a pretty big turnaround. Unfortunately, in Japan, they dropped from selling 230,000 to 170,000. But on the whole, worldwide sales are more than doubled compared to this period last year, which, Hopefully it's going, it's going up for them. Now, the flip side, unfortunately, of this coin is that the sales of the Nintendo 3DS have dropped like a rock. In this period in 2013, worldwide, they had sold 3.8 million Nintendo 3DS systems, the April through September 2013. April, September 2014, 2.0 million, approximately 2.1 million. In America, it's it's kind of hovering around, in America and Japan, it's hovering around half of what they had sold during this period last year. And that's a big deal. Because you can look and say, oh, well, Smash Brothers just came out and it sold a whole lot of copies and they have limited edition Smash Brothers stuff. And it's true. And the new 3DS just came out in Japan. Mm-hmm. And that's going to add to this. And that is also true. But the 3DS had, you know, it had cool new hardware, you know, last year too. It had the 2DS.
Right.
The 3DS had major, huge, big selling franchises last year too.
In that time period, what were the big releases?
I think Animal Crossing,
Fire Emblem.
Yeah. Like,
and the Pokemon too.
Pokemon.
Yeah.
I mean, those
that Pokemon launched at the same time as the 2DS, and so that was
That's a big
they sold a ton there.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the one hand, it's a tough comparison. On the other hand, to say, oh, well, they'll get their groove back because Smash Brothers, it's like, well, it's, you know, that's not going to be, if that's as big as Pokemon, that's huge. I don't think it's going to be as big as Pokemon. So, some ongoing 3DS issues. And Nintendo's forecast, they thought this fiscal year they were going to sell 12 million 3DSs. And it's like they're only up to 2 million total. So even if they have a great Christmas, it's like, oh, that's actually not going to be anywhere near that.
They do have a new Pokemon coming, the like Ruby Sapphire remake.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that'll be a system seller.
I know. Like, it's like they've played their hand. And so the question that becomes, so I do have a new Nintendo 3DS, which did I talk about that at all?
You've talked about it some.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about last week. I wasn't
right. Oh, okay, right. I do have a new Nintendo 3DS, the Japanese version. I'm not really into Monster Hunter, so it's not a big deal for me. You know, Bo, you would probably find that playing Smash Brothers is better because of the ability to use the C-stick to do smash attacks rather than have to, you know, jam the slide pad forward quickly and press a button. You can just sort of, like, nudge the C-stick a little bit and get that smash attack out. And so that will be a big use case potentially, but it's like, when is this thing coming to the United States Smash Brothers community for them to use this?
They'll have already all shifted to Smash on Wii U pretty much.
Maybe, potentially, you know? I mean, you know, the fact that you can take your 3DS, and I've really actually been surprised, even within my group of friends, who I don't see them take their 3DSs out a whole lot, but we've been at dinners or parties and I see people just, they're just sitting there playing four-player Smash Brothers. And they're just like, we didn't bring your 3DS to play Smash Brothers? It's like, it's really, it's actually catching on in my group of, you know, professional video game industry types in their 30s to, like, bring their 3DSs around to play Smash.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can only imagine what it's like for people who are, significantly more hardcore than this group is.
Yeah, it definitely, it's one of the first, like, multiplayer game, like 3DS multiplayer games, where the multiplayer component really benefits from, like, having it with you and playing it there with the people next to you.
And it's not having it in your pocket and getting street passes.
Right, yeah, because, like,
really, like, it was cool. You want to play? Let's play.
You know, it was cool to get street passes for, like, Animal Crossing or Fire Emblem or whatever, and you just get the thing, and then it's, like, it's there, and you're like, oh, I got a street pass. You see that little green flashing light, and it's cool. But that, you can just throw it in your bag and leave it there while you commute during the day, and then you don't think to take it with you when you, say, go out to dinner at night or something. But now people are actually, like you said, thinking about taking it. And then when other people also have said, hey, maybe I'll bring it with me, then you end up playing Smash at dinner.
And that's not really something that happened with, like, Mario Kart.
Yeah.
You know? Right. I mean, I did not see this really happening very much with Mario Kart. So that's very interesting to me that there's a new-ish behavior for a certain segment of consumer. And I don't necessarily see that going away with Wii U because
it's like, Smash on the go.
It's a
yeah.
separate thing. The Wii U version doesn't replace that particular mm-hmm. kind of behavior.
It replaces playing at home on the couch. Like me and my roommate will get our 3DSs out currently and play with each other. Now, once the Wii U one comes out, then we'll play the Wii U one, obviously.
Exactly.
But we'll still, you can't take the Wii U with to dinner.
You can't. Well, you could.
I guess you could.
But it would not be
much.
You'd be
significantly
like,
less.
Plug this in, you're at like Atelier Kren.
Yeah. Yeah.
Play this Smash Bros.
I mean, it also helps that, helps and or hurts, depending on how you look at it, that the Smash is inherently a multiplayer experience and the online component is way less good than the local multiplayer component. So
I'm actually going to stick on this idea for a second. I wonder if we will see people taking their Wii U with them because it is a clunky and inefficient portable gaming system that you have to plug in because, I mean, you already saw, like, you know, Stephen Totillo posted that picture of himself playing Pikmin 3 in an airport.
Right.
You can do that. Mm-hmm. Will we actually see people carrying around a Wii U with the gamepad? And if they're, like, traveling to a convention, if we go to PAX, are we going to go to the airport and see people huddling around a Wii U playing Smash in the airport on a Wii U using the gamepad screen?
I would think no, because the point of having it as a portable thing, that gamepad screen is really just for you. And
yeah, but it's a big enough screen that you could take that, put it on a stand on the Wii U, and have everybody have not using the gamepad to play it, using controllers to play it, and just using the screen as a display.
The thing, like, I get what you're saying, but to me, the whole point of having it on Wii U, like, mechanics-wise, it's the exact same game.
Yeah, I'm not saying this would be the major use case. I'm just wondering if...
I feel like it would be way more efficient because that, you know, it's easy enough to carry around just the Wii U and the gamepad, but to carry around that many controllers, it then becomes extremely clunky. And in fact, the most efficient controller usage in that situation would be to use the 3DS as a controller because you can sync it up and use the 3DS. And in that case, is it better to have four people looking at a single, like, 5x8 screen, however, I don't know the exact size of the Wii U gamepad screen, that, or just have everyone looking at their own, like, 3x whatever 3DS screen?
Right.
If you're already using the 3DS as a controller, you might as well look at it in your lap.
If you would be hardcore enough to do this, you might as well just bring the 3DS around with you. Yeah maybe.
Because I don't really see people carrying
If people really like the Wii U stages, though, or if
It would only be like for the stages.
Player battles, or because, of course, as we know, Nintendo has now announced a bunch of new stuff about Smash on the Wii U, and that 8-player local battles, giant stages to hold all of those players, a lot of tweaks to the stages. Like the 3DS stages, as it turns out, were simplified for the Nintendo 3DS, and on the Wii U you're going to see them as bigger. I wonder if we will if that will be a common occurrence that you will see people either like waiting in line at PAX with, you know, a Wii U or something like that.
I feel like if you're going to be carrying that sort of setup around, it would be way more efficient to carry also a projector than like 8 controllers, and then you can get 8 people to use their 3DSs that they have brought as controllers, but then you can project it up on any wall, and the size of carrying 8 controllers is larger than the size of carrying 1 projector. So if you're going down that road, you might as well go
semi-all in. I don't know, but the projector has to be powered. I mean, this is something you could do with plugging one thing. And anyway, I don't think it's going to be a major compelling use case, but I mean, Smash Brothers players can be pretty hardcore about playing Smash Brothers.
This is true.
Yeah, so...
I mean, of all the places to see this, like, PAX is a place where you might see something like that, but I don't think anybody's going to be taking their Wii U to dinner with them.
I don't think people are going to take their Wii U to dinner with them, I would say, in more like social situations or parties or things of that nature. Yeah. So anyway, Smash Brothers is coming for the Wii U. It's a big deal.
Well, before we go too far from that, another few things that got announced with Nintendo had a Nintendo Direct dedicated solely to Smash Bros. Wii U. Among the information they announced, some of it was the larger, bigger stages, the 8-player battles. But one kind of cool detail is they announced that Mewtwo, a character that was previously in Smash Bros. Melee but cut for Brawl,
To the great chagrin, right?
Of several, many, many players. Yeah. I mean, nobody likes their character getting cut, but Mewtwo was kind of a... There wasn't really another character like him. So it was very excitedly, to many players' enjoyment, announced that Mewtwo would be returning to Smash Bros. Wii U and 3DS as a DLC character in, I think, spring or summer 2015 or something. I don't know, sometimes down the road. So really cool for the Mewtwo players. They get Mewtwo back. Even cooler is this potentially opens the door to other DLC characters, because Nintendo has historically not really been on the up and up when it comes to DLC, at least for like major DLC content.
That was, yeah, I mean, DLC was a, you know, besides a few spotty things here and there, yeah, the downloading new levels sort of DLC, like that was something that Nintendo, it took them a while to come around to, and they really... They were so deliberate in this, as they are in everything, because their messaging was, we don't want people to feel like we're selling them an incomplete game and then making it up later by selling them DLC that should have been there in the first place. And so when they sold new levels for a new Super Mario Bros. 2 on the 3DS, that was kind of a big deal. And that was not that long ago. That was a couple of years ago, maybe. Yeah. Like,
I remember Fire Emblem Awakening had a fair bit of DLC.
Around from, you know, basically around the same
time. Yeah, that was like a year ago or something.
Right, so Nintendo and DLC, this is a new relationship for them.
Compare this to, say, you know, Street Fighter 4, Super Ultimate, whatever. They've had many, many DLC characters. Like, I mean, obviously it launches with a large roster of characters, but then they also have had additional characters released as DLC. And to a fighting game, like, a new character is really big. Like, that's effectively changes the whole game practically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, half the fun of, you know, mechanics-wise, Smash Brothers really has not changed a whole lot over the course of its iterations. The cool thing about new versions is new characters and new stages. And so the fact that a character is now coming from DLC and potentially more characters are coming from DLC is really cool.
It is really cool, and it's interesting because Nintendo runs the risk of unbalancing the game, right? Like, as soon as you have all these characters you're working with, and as soon as you start to add more. Now, at the same time, they're not pressured to get this character in there by a certain deadline.
Right.
So they can really take their time and make sure he plays nice with all the other characters before they, add him in there. But it's interesting that the idea of adding new fighters to Smash Brothers after the fact, and thus changing a lot of, you know, the strategies that players need to worry about, can be a very interesting thing. Yeah.
It also makes you wonder, they haven't announced anything to this degree yet, but so first off, they have said that they're not treating Smash Brothers as a like super competitive thing. They want the game to be fun, and then if people want to make it super competitive, they can do that, and the game sort of balances itself.
Right.
Having said that,
or, you know, they did it once. The game balances itself or not, you know, they say they're not concerned about it.
So having said that, it makes you wonder if they will take League of Legends, StarCraft, etc. approach of where characters and teams and whatever are tweaked and balanced constantly. Like, that's a constant ongoing conversation that between the developers and the community, and when a team or like when Protoss is overpowered in StarCraft, like, they tweak the build times and the units and the unit power and all this. And so
And the StarCraft competitors have to deal with it.
They have to deal with it. It's an active, ongoing thing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a little bit different in that case because StarCraft is only three races. And, you know, when you have one taking a lead over the others, that's not good. And you don't want everyone playing as that one of three. But still, like, it makes you wonder if maybe Nintendo will think about looking at the balancing of these characters.
Yeah.
Like, they have tweaked characters since Brawl. Some characters have gotten a little bit more powerful, a little bit less.
But they haven't gone in there. Now, Nintendo has Mario Kart, when people discovered an exploit in Mario Kart racing, where if you like drove off a certain cliff, it would think that it would place you really far up the track. Mm-hmm. They would go in and kill that. So, I mean, if there were bugs.
Yeah, so they have patched bugs, stuff like that.
They will patch the bugs out, exploits.
So in the past, you know, without patching of the previous Super Smash games, there wasn't a metagame in the same way that there is with Hearthstone or with, you know, other competitive
Destiny
games.
For
yeah, like they're
like the back and forth of yeah. the players discover something and Nintendo rushes to fix
right. There certainly is a metagame yeah. of the professional community where sure. they are all the characters have their tier listing, which yeah. is not actually the character's power level, but it's the number of people who are playing them at any one mm-hmm. time. And you know, sometimes a strategy may it's the metagame. The nature of a metagame is when. You know, in the case of a simple rock, paper, scissors thing, you tend to have one play style that beats out another yeah. play style. And that's the sort of thing you see in, say, something like Magic, like mm-hmm. the card games, you know, where specific deck styles will outright beat almost mm-hmm. always other deck
but
things.
But in this case, it's players discovering things, problems right. and then other players having to definitely. React
so,
to figure out a way to defend against it.
Right. So yeah. it's less of an outright rock, paper, scissors type thing, but it is still some characters are stronger against others a little bit, you know.
Right.
And in that case, when a certain character in the tournament metagame is being played a lot of people are using them because they're really good, then other players will start using that character's counter, so mm-hmm. to speak. It's not an outright counter, but it may be a more favorable matchup.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know how fiddly Nintendo is going to want to be
right.
with this.
Right. Yeah, so basically what I was saying is rather than
3DS and Wii U games is so much more, like with Destiny or Hearthstone or whatever, you load up the game and it logs you into the internet.
Right.
And it downloads Checks the new updates mm-hmm. and it's all built in. With Smash Brothers, it would do the same thing, but, you know, I mean, they can set it to do the same thing, but it's yeah. more of a process of, like,
right.
go to the eShop and download the whole update.
Right.
And, I mean, they don't want to be constantly mm-hmm. making people do that because people are just going to be like, maybe I just won't go online. And so, again, with Mario Kart, I think they did it, you know, once. You know, maybe a couple of more patches over the lifetime of the game.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know how fiddly they're going to want to be.
I don't know if they will do that, but yeah. it's just interesting to think about if they could.
I think we'll see them patch any just huge major issues that come up, mm-hmm. but not get into this sort of niggling like, oh, right. this character and that character, and let's tweak this a little bit, and let's take the damage on this from 17% to 18%,
right.
that sort of thing. And if they were to do it, maybe they'd roll it all out in one big mm-hmm.
yeah.
patch,
yeah.
but then you really run the risk of, you know, like...
Potentially.
Suddenly, the game that everybody was playing has like changed so fundamentally, and that yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think they want to get into it because, Bo, I think that you're right. I mean, they're fine with people having a competitive Smash Brothers scene.
Mm-hmm.
They are not explicitly designing the game mm-hmm.
right.
for that.
Right.
Although they do, I mean, clearly they look at what the player base is doing and are reacting to that because you have the For Glory mode in which. You know, every stage is Final Destination. You know,
it's no items, Final Destination.
No items, flat, you know, the flat stage, small flat stage, no items. That was not ever built into the game.
Right.
That was, you know, Final Destination was there, I guess, just in case. They probably put it in there just like, are people going to want to play on just a, you know, simple flat stage?
Right.
And then not only did they want to, but like everybody wanted to, and that's all they wanted to do. So they built that in and they were like, okay, well, we'll just have every stage have a special Final Destination
yeah.
version of it. So you don't always have to be in the same environment and you can have mm-hmm. whatever music and you can have whatever visuals you want, but you have that pure kind of gameplay. So they are listening and changing the game to benefit that group.
Right.
So it's not as if they're just completely, we don't care about you crazy people who took our fun game and turned it into a way of life. but at the same time, I don't think they want to, they definitely looked for solutions that were going to please those people without ruining it for like me or you who just wants to sit on a couch with our friends and have all the items on and have the wackiest, craziest stage and then, you know, see who... you know, is able to like fight through all of that chaos. Because really, even if you're losing, if ridiculous funny things are happening on screen all the time, it's still fun, or it should be fun to an mm-hmm. extent. Not in the Mario Kart way where they just make you win, but in a different
yeah.
way. In more of a Titanfall way. Titanfall, still, that is... It's so genius what they did with Titanfall that the second that you have lost a match that they that they don't say you lose. They say try to escape, and then when you escape, they're like, you escaped, great job, and you're not even thinking about the fact you lost the match. Here's a bunch of experience points. And it's just like, I feel really good. Did I lose? I mean, I guess I lost technically, but I don't know. I still feel like I did something cool. Yeah. So that. And then again, following on the Smash Brothers thread, this was interesting. This was the other shoe dropping, something that we had talked about long ago. And I forgot that I had actually made this tweet. I knew I had talked about it on the podcast at some point, but then I went back and I looked at my past articles and tweets and had found the first tweet that I tweeted from the E3 show floor where they had the Amiibos set out, the Nintendo's answer to Skylanders and Disney Infinity figurines. And I said, these things look way too good. Way. People were looking at these things. I mean, remember, people went to E3, you know, these figures, they were like super skinny, finely detailed, inlay, you know, incredible stuff. Inlay filigrees on Princess Peach's dress where there's like a laser etched little, you know,
the kind of stuff you see on like high-end collectible figurines.
Super high-end collectible looking, really, really nice looking stuff. And it occurs to me at this point, because, and you know, not out of nowhere, because I've reported on Skylanders, I've reported on Disney Infinity, I've talked to a lot of those guys, I've learned a lot about the business of the making of the figures and how do you make them and, you know, where do they come from. You know, I knew, you know, the Sorcerer Mickey figure, right? They had silver stars on his Sorcerer Mickey hat, right? And they distributed those figures at E23 Expo. When the final figure came out, the silver stars were gone because it added, you know, such and such amount of money per figure just to have silver paint on it that it, you know, just that little bit of silver paint, you know, tweaked the numbers enough that they were like, we have to get rid of this. We can't do it. So knowing that, to go in and look at these figures with this elaborate gold paint on Princess Peach and the metallic on Samus Aran and the, all of the, you know, the gorgeous, gorgeous sort of, you know, detailed, teeny tiny little details and every color in the rainbow on these figures, it was like, these are either going to be super expensive or they're going to get downgraded.
Guess which one happened.
Guess which one it was, because they announced they were going to be like $13 each. And then at the last possible minute, because they took these photographs of these gorgeous, gorgeous, and of course they always said, well, you know, they're prototypes, colors may vary, you know, design and colors may vary in the final version. It's like, okay, sure. But when people have now gotten to look at sort of what seemed to be the actual photographs, because they took these around to IGN and GameSpot and places of that nature, and they had them play with them, and then they took photographs of them. They really, they do not look good in certain, like some figures look better than others. Like Kirby still looks like Kirby because he was always very simple. Even though in the photograph they took of the Kirby, his like the eyeballs are like off-centered, you know, they're just off-centered enough that it looks kind of weird. But you know, Princess Peach, again, who was this super detailed figure, the details have been reduced, the sort of the etching on the dress is gone, her face does not look nearly as appealing as it did. All of the, anything that was sort of a fine detail, her hands, which were just sort of elegantly sculpted, each finger was sculpted, is now more like a blob hand, you know, like they just, the verisimilitude is not as what it should be.
There was the Link had, he was like perched on, like the platform that held him up was this really thin, like gossamer, clear pole.
That just, and now disappeared into the background, right?
And now it just like, he's just kind of plopped down on this.
He's basically sitting on like a pole or something.
A catheter. Just giant catheter.
With the droopiest of swords.
Yeah, and the, you know, the Wii Fit trainer, who was this very thin kind of character, has a massive sort of very visible plastic like boot around to keep her from breaking off. And it's like, And I, you know, people point this out, and I mean, the reactions to these people are, well, obviously they weren't going to be able to publish those figures.
Well,
and
no,
it's like,
but
well, if they weren't going to be able to, then why are they over-promising and under-delivering? Yeah. Why do you go to Amazon and see photographs of these prototype figures as the, you know, not pictures added by Amazon, like these are like Nintendo's mock-ups of the packaging and everything, and people are clicking pre-order, pre-order, pre-order on these things, thinking that is what they are getting, and then at the not the last minute, because it's still a month before the release, you know, less than a month, but about a month, you know, that's when they kind of pull the football away, and it's like, by the way, these things, some of them look like cake toppers, you know, like some of them just do not look good.
No, it is straight dentist office giveaway toy basket, grab one. Status.
Right.
So for you, you have every Marvel Disney Infinity figure.
Yeah, yeah.
And you keep them in box, and the aesthetics of it are a big part of it for you. Does the shift, the design shift from prototype to final for Nintendo, does that affect your buying decisions at all?
I feel like the buying decision for me is affected by the fact that so far they don't really do much of anything.
Right,
like,
right.
You know, it's not like, I mean, you have the Disney Infinity figures because they're functional because, like, you buy the Disney Infinity figure, that's the only way to play as that character. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have the figures, you know, you have the game. We're using all of the figures and playing with them in the game. Like, you know, there's more of an impetus to go buy it. Mm-hmm. With Amiibo, it's almost like they're thinking that kids are going to go buy one. Mm-hmm. You know, you're gonna buy one for your one character. And so that is kind of what's keeping me. It's like I don't really see the gameplay reason to own these things. Mm-hmm. Now, and again, yeah, I think maybe not so much for me because I don't think I was ever going to – you know, we have the Disney Infinity figures. Very few of them are displayed. We have a few that were out of the box for whatever reason. We tried to take Phineas and Agent P out of the two-pack box because otherwise we couldn't play with both of them together and stack up the power discs and play it. But otherwise we were able to just get away with, you can just take the box because it's near field communication. Contact is not required. They just put the box in the stand and it works. So we kind of figured, look, we don't have to unwrap them. Yeah. Why do it? But we will if we have to, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't think that I would get these figures to display them. I think there's a lot of people out there who, I mean, especially going by like the NeoGAF threads about this, you see a lot of people going, I canceled all my pre-orders because I saw these figures, I thought they looked amazing, and I wanted them on my shelf because they look so good, and now they do not look good anymore, so I don't want them all anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they need to be utilitarian, and I understand that, but I would imagine that Nintendo saw the demand and had to think of what it was based on, and you know, licensing is not their thing, but you have to wonder if a company like Funko or whoever, if they got a Nintendo license and started and people were releasing higher-end collectibles of the figures, how astonishingly well those would do.
Yeah. Like, I was basically just thinking the exact same thing. Like, why is there any benefit to them basically having two tiers of the Amiibos, you know, to have the low-tier version for, you know, playground kids effectively where they throw it in their bag and it needs to be durable and you know is not going to be displayed pristine on a shelf, but then to also have like a high-end version that maybe costs two or three or four times
as
much for the people who want to keep them pristine for the collectors,
for somebody,
you know,
who wants something that really is that beautiful and will pay up for it.
People are obviously willing to pay up an extra $20 or $30 for the collector's edition.
I don't. I think when Nintendo kind of had to make the decision of, you know, these figures are going to cost a whole bunch of money, or we're going to have to downgrade them, and they chose to downgrade because maybe people actually wouldn't pay that much money.
Well, it depends on the numbers.
Not enough people.
You know, if fewer people pay more money, you can also have a smaller production run at a cost and kind of break even slash make.
Yeah, because I was thinking of, you know, the people who are willing to they buy like the legendary edition of Halo that comes with the Master Chief helmet and, you know, these different special editions for 20 or 30 or 40 bucks more.
And that can be very important and you know.
Yeah, like to me, I'm like, I want to buy the cheapest version of the game possible to play the game, and I don't want, you know, all this other extra stuff. But they're obviously, because they keep making crazy pre-orders and crazy special editions to games, people obviously are still buying them. So
that is interesting. Would they do different tiers for different types mm-hmm. of players? I don't think anybody has really considered that at this point. Like Disney Infinity has not done it, Skylanders has not done it, but they haven't needed to. And this is so here's the thing that really puzzles me about hashtag AmiiboGate. Okay. What Nintendo just did is so un-Nintendo. It is so unlike Nintendo. And I mean, really stretching all the way back, I'm going to write something about this, but I want to kind of get the Amiibos in hand first. I want to write a whole thing. I believe this is in the book Game Over. That's David Sheff's 1993 narrative kind of, history book. David Sheff's nonfiction book about Nintendo that was kind of like, for a lot of us, it was kind of the genesis of thinking about this sort of long-form journalism about video games, very influential. And for a long time, it was some of the only information we really had about, the inner thought process of Shigeru Miyamoto. And Miyamoto pointed out, and this you'd read right past this at the time as a tiny little detail, but it was such a lens into Nintendo's what was at the time a quite unique thought process about Nintendo and why they were so good at making video games. He said to David Sheff, "We always draw the dot character first. We always draw the pixel character first, and then from that we make other artwork, like the artwork that would go on the packaging, for example." And that was such a perfect distillation of what they did. They, instead of having a concept artist, I'm a concept artist that just drew this enemy, that how in the name of God would you ever make a sprite out of this enemy? You know, which is something that, like, when Mike Micah, friend of the podcast, making iDarb now, when he was working with Ed Freeze making Halo 2600, Ed Freeze was making a Halo, a version of Halo in the 2600, and just one of the biggest problems was just drawing sprites. It's so hard to take this already established character and do this sprite version that's instantly like, oh, I know what that is. What Nintendo would get around that by just making the sprite character, then doing the artwork. So you look at the artwork, and then you look at the sprite character, it's like, oh, it's that guy. And when people are like, oh, Nintendo's worlds are like these cartoons, it's like, yeah, because you see the game, and you see the artwork, and it's like, oh, they draw it so well. It's like, yes, because, Mario with he has a mustache because it's easier to draw a mustache than a mouth. So what does that all have to do with this? Why, in the name of God, would this company take the Super Smash Brothers designs of the characters, which are long, spindly, very, very difficult to show in an action pose and make a little figurine out of them. Why on earth would they make those the designs of the Amiibo figures? Because Skylanders, they do what Miyamoto would do, which is they design the figure first, and then they put that figure in the game, so they're identical. They don't design a game character, then try to figure out how to make a figure out of it. With Disney Infinity, the characters are already designed, but they all have a certain design sense running through them. They were kind of newly kind of re-envisioned, some more than others, for these figures to create a consistent look across all of the figures, and quite frankly, something that was unique to Disney Infinity. Like if you look at, Sully, from Monsters, Inc., he has this very sort of an angular kind of design. And everybody kind of has like the square jaws and stuff like that. They all look like Disney Infinity figures. And of course it works really well because they are little figurines. They're only a couple of inches tall. So what you do is you make the figure squat and short. Something that's going to work as a figurine design. And, again, I also believe that, I think like the Elsa and Anna, the frozen characters, the female characters, because they're so detailed, because they have so many small details, like those tend to be like the more expensive figures in the Disney Infinity line from a cost manufacturing perspective. So of course Nintendo makes every figure super, super detailed, because instead of just designing Amiibo figures first as figures and then bringing them into the game, or just saying, screw it, like, look, this is the the Mario figurine works with Mario in Smash Brothers, but he's his own separate thing. It's just the representation of Mario. It doesn't have to be perfectly 100% accurate to the sprite that's on screen in Smash Brothers. It's the Mario amiibo. But instead of doing that, they designed them in the game first and then made them into figures. Yeah. And then what takes the hit? The figures.
Yep.
Because they realize, oops, we actually can't make them look this good. And so that's, people look at it and it's like, well, it's ugly. And it's like, they could have designed a Peach figure that looked beautiful as a figure, mm-hmm. but they didn't. They just 3D printed Peach's Super Smash Brothers model and were like, done. Yeah. And then this is the hole they dig themselves into. Rant over. I'll probably write about that. That was your sneak preview of the Nintendo ass backwards, the amiibos, and now they get to eat dirt for it, basically. Anyway, I want to actually get them in hand because, you know, yes, the fact that the E3 figures were kind of a lie, like, you know, It's a letdown, but maybe they'll be okay anyway. Maybe people will buy them anyway and still be happy with them if they didn't see the old version. You know, it's just that, it's just bad optics. It's like if they had gone with this the whole time, if they showed us what they would look like in terms of production, or under-promised and over-delivered. You know, if they had like lowballed those E3 figures. But it's like, man, they got so much mileage out of the lie figures. They showed them at E3, and they showed them at PAX, and they showed them in videos, and they showed them on the Amazon page in high definition. Like, all, so many people have seen those figures, and that's what's lodged in their head right now. Hashtag AmiiboGate.
Rant actually over.
Rant actually over. For reals this time. I mean it. I don't know what else to talk about. Oh, I played Sunset Overdrive, but I mean, I've been talking for a long time.
You got EA news.
Yeah, there's almost nothing to the news other than it's pretty cool news. EA tweeted earlier this week that Star Wars Battlefront, or Star Wars Battlefront 3, whatever you want to officially call it, is finally coming out. It'll be out in holiday 2015, right around the time that the new Star Wars Episode 7 will be out. So it's a pretty logical timing. But yeah, this game's been long anticipated and pretty cool. Other Star Wars news, they've recently, has it actually come out or just announced that Star Wars TIE Fighter and X-Wing are coming to or are now on GOG, Good Old Games, or doing like an HD remake of them or something. It's just that they're finally digitally available.
What's going on with Good Old Games is that Disney LucasArts, you know, effectively Disney because it bought Lucasfilm, they are putting lots and lots of the most demanded, you know, LucasArts classics onto goodoldgames.com, downloadable, DRM-free, which is great. A few of these have been available on Steam. A few of them, this is their digital distribution debut. You've not been able to legally acquire these games without buying a used CD-ROM disc.
what is that?
Well, besides being redundant.
Exactly.
Yeah. In decades, and so the big ones are X-Wing and TIE Fighter, the lauded, you know, space dogfight games.
Right.
Sam and Max Hit the Road, and for those three games, this is their digital distribution debut. And again, they are cheap and they are DRM free. Buy them once, put them on whatever platform, you know, whatever computer you want to put them on for the rest of your life.
Yep.
Which is awesome. I bought Sam and Max. Didn't need to because I have a CD-ROM Sam and Max.
Yeah,
but
still bought it.
For God's sakes, I'm gonna pay them the $6 to ensure that they get the message of me voting with my wallet that I want more of this stuff. Comes with a very nice PDF scan of the original manual and the original hint book. The whole hint book that they sold for the game is included as a PDF. Which is great because it actually, the hint book and the manual have Steve Purcell's Sam and Max comics strewn throughout them. Very, very funny stuff. So yeah, I'm excited about Sam and Max Hit the Road. Other people are much more excited about X-Wing and TIE Fighter.
Right.
And this is the tip of the iceberg because they said that, so there's also Indiana Jones, Fate of Atlantis, the Monkey Island Special Edition, which is the one that has, you can play it like normal or you can play it with updated graphics. and I'm blanking on the last one, but Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh.
Slightly less classic than the others, but anyway. But they're releasing more than 20 LucasArts games. So hopefully we'll see your Maniac Mansions. And hopefully we'll see your other LucasArts games. Maybe Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail, or the Last Crusade, because that was a pretty good one, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's awesome.
That's great.
That's wonderful. And it's like, it's just all anybody, you know, was waiting around for Lucas to do for the longest time.
Yeah.
Finally.
People been asking for it.
And it's like, I mean, it's so great that... You know, when Disney bought Lucasfilm, it was like, oh, man, they're acquiring... You know, Disney just acquired Maniac Mansion.
Yeah.
Did they care, you know? Did they just subsume all of this? Yeah. Are they just going to sit on it forever? It's like, nope. There's actually people within Disney who are willing to listen and work these deals and, like, make this stuff available in a super friendly way. I don't think Disney is planning on making any money off of this, but for the love of God, it is such an easy goodwill thing to do, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know, it seems like when you look at the many empires that were once their own and are now collected under the Disney umbrella, like, not that they didn't have them before, but Disney, as you know well, Chris, and I think that, you know, in our cover story, what we get
out
of the November issue is this look at how Disney Animation turned itself around, and some of that was... that when the heads of Pixar, John Lasseter and Ed Catmull came in, they knew that there was so much passion for Disney in the staff that, like, the executive layer was where it had lost its way, but the people who worked at Disney loved its legacy so much that they bring, like, when you go into a company and you find, like, honest affection and nostalgia for the products of its past, that translates automatically into fan service because fans work there. And it's just there's no better recipe for things like this, for the GOG move. And I would only hope that, like, that'll happen with Marvel and other things as well. As, you know, not that there's as long a history of good Marvel games, but certainly there's some stuff that I'd like to see pop back out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, you know, a lot of those Marvel games having been designed by other publishers.
That's true.
It's tougher to do that. But this stuff they own free and clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, nobody else is hanging on to these licenses, so. Yeah, but, so that's cool. And, you know, Star Wars Battlefront coming back is probably exciting for people.
Been asked for a long time.
Right.
People are now very excited.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, at first it was kind of like, I mean, I definitely, when EA got the exclusive rights to do all of the Star Wars, any hardcore Star Wars games, it was kind of like, well, great. So all this stuff about, like, all these other developers maybe getting to work on Star Wars, it's like, nope, it's just EA. But, I mean, it's almost like those games are just becoming they're not nearly as important anymore because Disney retains the rights to have smaller Star Wars games happen, and those can go anywhere. And EA really has the rights to the big AAA experiences, but how many of those are going to get made, right? So whatever.
At least one now, apparently, finally.
A game.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there was always the comment that, you know, like, Visceral was going to do some sort of a Star Wars game too, right? That's not Battlefront, though, because Battlefront is...
I don't know. Battlefront is DICE, and there's, like, almost no information. There was, like, literally a tweet.
I don't know if they said Visceral was going to work on something, or everybody just sort of assumed Visceral was going to work on something. I have no idea. They're still hard at work on Battlefield Hardline, coming eventually. Yep.
Speaking of Battlefield, with this Battlefront announcement, there's also a new Battlefield coming in 2016, because, of course, there is.
Of course.
That's all there is to that.
Keep on keeping on, EA. One of these days, one of them will be good. I did not realize, speaking of Battlefield, which is now synonymous, I think, with... botched online launches. Well, first of all, that class action lawsuit that people were filing against Electronic Arts trying to allege essentially false advertising, I believe that was dismissed. I believe that is gone. But Sony's Drive Club, which, did you know that Drive Club came out? Because I didn't.
I did not know
has
that.
Has been plagued with online issues for the last... you know, few weeks since it actually got released. So
since however long it's been since we didn't know it came out.
Yeah, basically. So people are pretty upset about that. But it's almost at the point where it's like, has any big online game come out and not had huge problems?
Yeah.
Destiny didn't. So I guess basically Blizzard is the only Blizzard.
Yeah, they're pretty good at
company that's like immune to these problems.
I mean, even like major World of Warcraft launches have been pretty fine. Although Diablo 3 was terrible.
Oh yeah.
So they're not totally immune.
Yeah. True. But it's like they fixed it
pretty quick. Like, it was just like day of. And it was just like everyone wanted to play this game.
Right.
And within the first week or so, it was spotty. But then they worked it out.
Right.
And I mean, you could sort of say the same thing about the new Sims game. Or, what was it? Just the Sims? No, the SimCity. SimCity.
SimCity.
Which was a terrible launch, but then it's now that not everyone in the world is playing it, it's kind of worked itself out.
Yeah, but it took them a really long time to work that out, and it was bad for them. And I mean, they worked it out by deleting features from the game.
Right.
Like they took out, you know, cheetah speed and all that kind of stuff. They just cut stuff out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. So we basically just talked about Nintendo for most of this time. And then
it's happened before.
A little touch about EA. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Peter, how are you doing?
I'm going to play a game one of these days.
you think?
Yeah, that's what I keep telling myself.
I know you like video games.
I do like video games, but I've got a couple of really long flights next week. And so Lords of Waterdeep, which came out last month for iPad. Which is a tabletop game set in the D&D universe that I was excited about the iOS integration, and hopefully we'll get a chance to take that for a long spin and report back. But
okay,
nice.
I feel bad.
Yeah,
I feel bad.
Yeah. Oh, play Desert Golfing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah. Do you know anything about it? Just go ahead and play it, and then we'll come back and we can discuss it.
Perfect.
Great. What else? You know. I should mention this.
Hmm.
So, by the time you listen to this should already have happened. I'm going to do a interview, or a, you know, yeah, interview for a documentary that is getting kickstarted right now. The name of the Kickstarter is, I believe, You Are Now Earthbound, and it's from Fangamer, which is the company. If you ever go to PAX, you always see Fangamer with a huge, huge booth, and they're selling all these great kind of fan-created, you know, T-shirts and trinkets and Nintendo, you know, like playing cards that are based on The Legend of Zelda, but it's all like, it's all fan art, you know, it's all like, you know, really kind of like, you know, homage to these, you know, not just Nintendo, but classic video games in general. Really cool, really nicely designed stuff. They do music albums. So they're doing an Earthbound Kickstarter. And Fangamer grew up from Earthbound fans. It grew out of Starmen.net, that early kind of Earthbound, you know, American fan repository. The Kickstarter is, they're going to do a big book all about Earthbound. They're going to do an album of remixes, and they're going to do a documentary called Earthbound USA, scheduled to come out sometime in 2016, just about the long-suffering American Earthbound fan community that asks and asks and asks and gets almost nothing, about, you know, the long, long wait for Earthbound on Virtual Console, the long, long you know, wait that's still ongoing for Mother 3, the sequel, to get released here in the U.S. And so, I mean, my first interview with Shigeru Miyamoto, like, I asked him about this way back in the day, and some of those comments kind of became notorious, and, you know, since then, I mean, there was that incident of the game journalist when Nintendo had that robot chicken thing during its Nintendo Direct, and like one of the quote-unquote game journalists in the media was yelling at Reggie for Mother 3, and, you know, was that guy me? Was that guy a composite of me and Stephen Totillo? I have no idea. And we're just going to talk about that whole history of, you know, the Earthbound fandom here in the U.S. So that should be really fun. I think they listed my name on the Kickstarter as somebody who's going to be in the movie, so I can confirm that is not baloney, and they're not just trying to take your money, although they are just trying to take your money. And the Kickstarter got funded, but it has many more days left to go. And so there seems to be some pretty cool prizes and, you know, or rewards and stuff like that. So,
they're just starting work already.
Yeah, go check it out because it's going to be pretty neat. And then I will do my best to say interesting things at the camera. And we'll do it, you know, we'll probably do it with me in front of my video game collection, too, because, you know, video games.
Because video games.
Because video games. Our motto. So, yeah, that's a thing that's happening that I think is pretty neat. Black Glove Kickstarter, not...
It's turned around a little bit, but not as much. I mean, it's up to, like, 140, maybe 150K now, which is better than... A week ago, it was at like 100K.
Right.
But so it's starting, the tide is turning a little bit. But I mean, it was always sort of expected if anything would happen, it would happen in the final week. And they're now kind of going into the final week. I think they have maybe 8 or 9 days left. Because most projects get funded either in the beginning or at the end, you know, as
you. 500?
Yeah, they're going for 550K. So they'd still have a long way to go. But they have overhauled their video as promised, are doing more featurettes and everything, talking about it. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like the worst part to me is like, I mean, this game sounds so cool. Like, I want to play this game, but I don't know if it's going to happen.
Right. Well, you know, I don't think the Kickstarter is going to succeed. I certainly hope that.
I mean, the impression I got from
up with another method of funding.
You know? Like I asked Joe Fielder, the CEO or co-founder, or whatever, of Day for Night Games, who's leading design on this. You know, I asked him, "What's the plan if the Kickstarter fails?" And basically, he's not even thinking about it right now.
He's saying
if you want to play the game, this is your chance to play it.
I wouldn't, and I mean, even if he has a plan, I wouldn't discuss it either.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just deflect. I would get right off of that question and I would say, no. If you want to play the game, this is how you're going to do it.
Right.
Because as soon as you say, oh, well, we have a backup plan, well, then people are going to be like, well, I'm not going to back your game.
Right.
We're going to bring it out anyway. I mean, that was kind of one of the problems with Republic, which you talked about in your piece about, you know, turning around your failing Kickstarter, is that they did such a great job on their video and their presentation. It was all like they had, I mean, you know, Ryan Payton had gone from Metal Gear Solid to Halo to this.
Right.
You know, he was super, super polished and perfected with the pitch and everything. That it looked like, you know, some really well-off company who just happened to be asking for your money and that this was a game that they were going to make. And it didn't really have that, like, no, actually, we don't have any money and we really do need your help. And we're really smart about making videos.
Yeah. Like, I mean, one of the kind of especially cool, not cool, but impressive things about the Black Glove is it does have that air of polish to it. Like, the video looks good. You looking at the gameplay footage, it looks like BioShock, basically.
Yep.
And this is a game that this team of like six plus a few freelancers have made since like May in their spare time. It's not like they've been working on it for 3 years in their spare time. Like,
but it looks so good that you almost want to look at it and go, well,
like, I want to know what they could do.
I'm not going to kickstart it, but maybe I'll just play it when it comes out.
Yeah.
But it's like, but it's not going to come out.
Right.
And I mean, it's tough. I don't want to. I always make sure that we don't talk about Kickstarter projects in the sense of, well, it's the game does this and the game is that and the game is this. It's like, well, it's not a game yet. It's a pitch with some screenshots that they've kind of lovingly put together. It's a proposal for a game that they want to build, and it may not actually exist yet. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I really am very curious as to, nice if somebody did like a, you know, real survey of like Kickstarter backers of people who backed stuff in 2012. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, why aren't you backing stuff in 2013 or 2014? Are you because the project doesn't sound as good to you?
Yeah.
Is it because you backed stuff in 2012 and you're still waiting for that stuff to get to
you? You've been burned.
Yeah.
Like, have you been burned? And is it turning you off of new projects?
Right. And again, as I've said in the past, even when those 2012 projects get fulfilled, there might be that feeling with some people of like, oh yeah, I guess I don't really want this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted it then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the other X Irrational project, the Fire and the Flood, or what, Flame and the Flood, it has hit and surpassed its 150K goal.
Right.
But again, that was a much lower goal.
It was a lower goal, and the pitch
and it was a clearer pitch. Yeah.
Yeah. High concept. It was super easily understandable, and it was also this is a survival game. You know, like the genre was already established. There's a group of fans who want that type of game experience. There's not a lot of those types of game experiences. So it's like, oh, I have to pay you money because otherwise I'm not going to get this experience that I want. With the Black Glove, it's one of those things where that is a game that if it succeeded, it would come out, and then by word of, if it were good, if it were awesome, then by word of mouth, more and more people would learn about it. And then you'd have a Gone Home type situation where it comes out,
and it's
a
really
couple
cool.
of people play it, and then only by word of mouth and people convincing others to play it do they play it and they buy it, and then you get to the point where they sell, you know, 700,000 of them. But it doesn't have that big first day.
Yeah, if you tried to kickstart Gone Home or The Stanley Parable or something, it would not work at all.
Nope. Would not be possible. It would not have been possible for them to explain to people what Gone Home was, why you needed to pay for it. And again, even Steve Gaynor standing up and saying, "Hi, I made Minerva's Den for BioShock 2," it wouldn't work because you have people who are like, "I was the whatever on BioShock Infinite," and nobody cares. And not that nobody cares, but it's not enough to put you over the top. And it's just interesting, like I wonder if this is all a big part of the process of would-be crowdfunders learning the ins and outs of how do you structure, because it's not the project per se, it's the pitch, right? So it's like, how do you structure that pitch to, because I mean, this was one of the most fascinating things that I kind of learned reading this story, is learning that in fact both Republic and Black Glove, because of the big media coverage that they both got, which is way more media coverage than your average Kickstarter gets, they had buttloads of page views.
Tons of people coming to the page, watching their video.
So wasn't
all
the
this.
Problem with that? And they got them on the page, they got them to watch the video, but they did not convert them. And so it's what's really going to be a thing, if it's not already a thing, is like learning how do you make that magical conversion from page view to purchase. Because it's not like you get X number of page views, you get Y number, you know, you get a certain percentage of those are going to buy it. It's all in the metaphysical realm of the pitch itself and how do you do it, which is... If you're gonna do a Kickstarter, you gotta think about that. You have to think about, if I get that page view, how do I get them to give me the money? And that may be very different for everybody. Is it the quality of the video? Is it the monetary nature of the tiers? Is it the rewards on the tiers?
Yeah.
I think Ryan Payton had an interesting comment when he was like, "Oh, you know, don't worry so much about that $10,000 tier level. Like, don't waste your time perfectly crafting."
Because it's like, for $10,000, what could you possibly offer? Like, most of the time, like something that he said that I didn't end up using the quote for, but basically, like, most of the time, that $5,000 or $10,000 tier is just like, oh, come visit the dev team or something. And it's like, that's not worth $10,000 worth of your time, but maybe somebody is... you know, willing to pay it, but
it's worth it to somebody. I mean,
but he was like, you know, I don't want to sell myself short or anything, but my time isn't worth $10,000 to like spend an hour with you.
Yeah. So you give them everything that's in the previous tiers, and then you say dinner with the developers.
Yeah.
You get an office visit. You get to hang out with us.
You maybe get to design something in the game, or build a character after you or something.
Right. But don't sit there and hire someone to paint this elaborate portrait that you're going to give the $10,000 person, or, you know, go too crazy with it. Because actually, I mean, I think that actually it works for me. You know, I think it's great. I also think that if you're a game developer who is you know what they could have offered? I mean, again, this only gets you those couple of high-end kind of deals, too. But, I mean, you know, maybe it would help. Because as soon as somebody buys in at the $10,000 level, well, they're a person with a lot of money. They probably have a lot of influence. They probably have a lot of friends, you know? Then maybe they get more of their friends to donate at the lower levels. Because now you have somebody who has a real vested interest in wanting to make the Kickstarter happen. So... because they've bought in and they've bought in and they don't get the fun reward. I almost feel like the Black Glove guy should have talked to like Ken Levine. I mean, I don't know if they're like on good speaking terms with this guy or if he would have done it. But it's like, go find the people that you know in the video game industry who are big names and have them get on board for the
even just an endorsement, like,
well, an endorsement, yes, for the $10,000 dinner.
Oh yeah, then to like meet Ken Levine. Not so, just meet these people
so
making the game.
One $10,000 tiers have dinner with us. Another one is we're going to fly you to some other city that we're not in, and you're going to have dinner with, you know, Bo Moore from Wired, or you're going to have dinner with Peter Rubin.
Yeah.
The next tier.
This was how the Veronica Mars funded their stuff. Yeah. They were like, they had, you know, get a voicemail recording by Kristen Bell or, you know, Jason Doring or whatever his name is, the, you know, the stars of the movie.
Get a voicemail recorded by John St. John. And you just go to those people and you say, okay, how many can you really commit to? It's like Kristen Bell. Could you record 10 voicemails, you know?
Yeah.
Can you record 100?
That's a minimal time effort from her to get like a lot of money.
10 a day if we tell you exactly what to say, if we take all the burden off of you. Right. And it's like, then you have Kristen Bell tweeting about your project. You
get
know?
Get a
and
voicemail now, recorded by me to her hundreds of thousands of followers.
Right. So if you're and then you have people pledging who don't even want the game anymore. They just want that thing. So I would definitely suggest, I mean, if you're out there and you're thinking about doing a Kickstarter and you're not personal friends with Kristen Bell, then, you know, obviously this does not apply to you. But it's like, it always seems to me that if you can find something that costs you effectively, you know, $0, where it's really, if all you're really doing is like saying you get to go to dinner with this person and that person agrees to do it, you know, like, set that up, make that happen. You know, get that Rolodex out and think to yourself, how can I exploit all of the friendships that I have?
Yeah.
And if you need any of us for your $10,000 dinner, just, you know, email us and
we'll yeah, 25 grand, you can be on an hour of the Game Life podcast.
I don't think we can do that.
Can we not? Not for any particular tier. We're saying like some future mystical game. Call us up and ask us if that's okay first.
If we kickstart a game, we'll do that. But yeah, I mean, I almost feel like that might have been a missed opportunity for them because I feel like maybe they do have the ears of some people who would like to. And, you know, and then, yes, you do, in fact, have to go sit through a dinner with whatever crazy axe murderer, you know, with $10,000 buys the
dinner
tier. Crazy
rich axe murderer.
Well, they have a lot of money from all the axe murdering.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But I mean, even back though to the original point that Ryan Payton was saying was that, you know, don't stress too much about these $10,000 tiers because, yeah, even if you do sell, say, five people at the $10,000 level, that's 50 grand of your 500K versus selling 10,000 people at the $20 or $30 or $50 level.
That's right.
And so it's when you have 100 or 200 or 500,000 people coming to your page, but only 1,000 of them are converting to backers instead of 10 or 100,000.
Yeah.
You know, it's that $5 or $10,000, it moves the needle a little bit, but in terms of the overall project, it's a drop in the bucket.
Yep.
You know, it's not 10,000 people pledging $50.
Yeah. I think that crowdfunding is absolutely 100%. It's here to stay, you know? Like, whether or not Kickstarter in and of itself is, or, you know, somebody figures out a better method of doing this. And quite frankly, you know, that a company could take a lot of Kickstarter's business by coming in and figuring out a better way to design their web pages or giving you more of a design. Because right now you do a Kickstarter, you know, it looks like a Kickstarter page, you know? You know, if a company were to come in and say, okay, but you get to design your whole crowdfunding page and you get to use whatever design tricks that you want to use, you know, to get people, you know, buying in or whatever, like, you know, that,
like
that
Star Citizen,
I have to go start a company, guys. Excuse me. Sorry. Found my millions of dollars. Star Citizen.
Yeah. They've got, I don't know, $55 million or something is the most crowdfunded project in history.
Yeah.
But of that, only like a million or so came from Kickstarter.
Right, because that was a limited thing, and then they had their own thing where you can just like, buy in, you know, as soon as you want to. But just the idea of even if you're just running that limited campaign, like a company could take a lot of Kickstarter's business if they were to discover the secret to conversion and then bake that into your site experience so they can go to you and you say, you know, you can put your project on Kickstarter, you can put your project over here, and you're going to get 10% higher returns if you go with our service, and then we're going to take 5% less money off the top end. So, you know, wouldn't you go over to Kickstarter at that point? So, you know, there's a lot that's going on. It's just interesting that we're in this, like, we had this, you know, tremendous year of 2012, and now we're in 2014, and game developers are struggling to get the money. It's like the shine is off, but the core of the idea is still really solid. So it's just a question of figuring out why people are a little down. Because, again, you do that survey, and it's like, well, are you fatigued?
Yeah.
Or are the projects that are happening right now just not getting you as excited?
Like in 2012, you had capitalizing on a market that was totally untapped, like basically the adventure game market and the like isometric strategy game market.
Yep. And these people who you've been waiting for, like, somebody to do a sequel for this game for so long, for a decade, and then it all happens at once and it's like, take all the money. But now the projects are less like, here's this super anticipated thing that you've been drooling over forever, and more like, hey, here's a new idea.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, I have been waiting for that, though. It's like, I've been waiting for the Space Quest guys to make a new game for, you know, since college, which isn't out yet. But I keep saying that. And one of these days, it's just going to show up as a surprise. Yeah. It'll just be a surprise. So anyway, there's your Game Life podcast for this spooky Halloween. Hope you had a nice Halloween or are having a nice Halloween. If you're listening to this while you're trick-or-treating, pick me up some candy. Send it to me.
No fun size.
Get no. Out
of here. Oh, God.
A real bag.
What an Orwellian name. What a...
Double plus fun.
check us out on social media, on Twitter. Only Twitter. KobunHeat is my name. KobunHeat. # AmiiboGate.
And I'm at Proven Self, where I probably talk significantly more than I do in this podcast right now.
You just haven't been playing a lot of video games.
I know.
It's all right.
It happens.
We're happy to have you here.
Yay!
Yeah.
Proven Self. That's ProvenSelf.
And you can find me on the Twitters at UseBombsWisely. That's UseBombsWisely.
Thank you all so very much for listening. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here once again. Always a pleasure. We will be back in the studio next week. Goodbye.